I sense that she is enjoying all of this. It's like a new game for her. Instant motherhood. But I am not angry with her. My own mother is home in bed, zonked out on headache medicine. If I am angry at anyone this morning, it's Mom. Finally, I convince Bitsy that it is okay for her to leave. I reassure her that I will be just fine, and reluctantly she stands up, then embarrasses me by kissing my cheek, as if she won't see me for a year. I breathe a sigh of relief when she is gone. I am shown into the guidance counselor's office at last. We talk about what courses I should take. I tell him what I was taking in Atlantic City, and he arranges a schedule for me here. English, something called American Cultures, Geometry, and French too. What about science? He asks, pulling on his earlobe. We try to encourage our sophomores to take chemistry. I'd rather take astronomy, I say. I'm getting better and better at identifying stars, planets, and constellations. We don't offer astronomy. Well, then, I'll just skip a science course and take typing. He looks up at me. I don't think I can handle chemistry right now, I explain. Why should I kill myself with work, I think. I'm only going to be here for a little while, and the truth is, I'm not sure I'd be able to memorize all the symbols that go with chemistry, especially after missing more than a month of school. All right, he says. He doesn't give me a hard time about it. He schedules me for typing instead. I am late getting to my first period class, which is English. I hand my card to the teacher, who is a young guy wearing jeans and a sweater. His name is Mr. Vanderhoot. He reads my card out loud. Davis Wexler. Davy, I tell him. Everybody calls me Davy. Sure. Okay, Davy, have a seat. Anywhere's fine. We're reading Dickens' Great Expectations. Have you read it? No. Good. You can pick up a copy after class. And get the notes from somebody smart. Let's see. He looks around the room. Try Jane. Jane, raise your hand. There she is, he says to me. Mr. Vanderhoot seems flaky. I like him already. After class, Jane comes up to me. That's why my parents named me Jane, she says. What? I'm confused. You know, that Davis-Davy business. With a simple name like Jane, you never run into trouble. Oh, that, I say. I'm used to it. You can take my notes home tonight. They're good. Thanks. We discover that we both have second period free, and we walk outside together. Jane is tall and blonde, and she would be beautiful except for her chin, which is practically non-existent. We cross the parking lot, then the walking bridge over Diamond Drive, and go into a sleazy store, where Jane buys V8 juice and pretzels. I don't like V8, so I get a can of grapefruit juice instead. Outside the store, a group of boys wearing cowboy boots and 10-gallon hats call lewd things to us. Jane ignores them and mutters, stomps. We cross back over the walking bridge and sit on the grassy area in front of the high school. There is a cool breeze, and Jane pulls her poncho around her while I zip up my jacket. Where are you from? Jane asks, guzzling V8 juice from the can. Atlantic City, I tell her. Where's that? California? She asks. No, New Jersey. Oh, right. New Jersey. Yes, I say, amazed that she thought Atlantic City is in California. I guess I was thinking of Studio City. That's in California. She nibbles on a pretzel. Atlantic City. That's where the Miss America pageant is held, right? Right, I say. My sister was a state finalist one year, but she lost out to this girl who could whistle Beethoven. Jane polishes off the rest of the pretzels, brushes the crumbs from her hands, and says, So you just moved up here? Yes, a few weeks ago. Is your father a physicist? No, I say. My father's dead. It is the first time I have said that to anyone. Oh, Jane says. I'm sorry. He died over the summer, I tell her. Of a heart attack. Once I get started, I can't stop myself. He died in his sleep. Everyone says it was a good way to go. That there was no pain. He was only 34. Why am I doing this? Why am I telling her this story? I don't know what to say, Jane tells me. It sounds terrible. My uncle's a physicist, I say. We're living with him and my aunt. I want to change the subject now. I want to get away from how my father died. Where are you from? Me? I'm from right here. Los Alamos. Really? Yes, I was born here. I've never lived any place else. But I've been to Kansas. That's where my grandparents live. And I've been to Tennessee. My father worked at the lab there, at Oak Ridge, for 6 months. It's a lot like here. She smashes her V8 can and tosses it up into the air, then catches it. A few drops of juice trickle out and land in her hair. Where are you living? White Rock or the Hill? The Hill, I say. The western area. How about you? Bathtub Row, she tells me. Look, I've got to run now. I've got another class. I'll meet you later and give you my notes, okay? Sure. Okay. At dinner, I tell Bitsy and Walter about Jane. She lives on Bathtub Row. Jason laughs and spits milk out of his mouth and nose at the same time. Is that near Toilet Terrace? He asks. Or Sink Street? Bitsy explains that Bathtub Row is the most prestigious area in town. The houses there are on the grounds of what used to be the exclusive Los Alamos Boys School. In the old days, before Los Alamos became the Atomic City, the boys' school was all that was up here. Then in the 40s, when Oppenheimer and the other famous scientists gathered to develop the bomb, the most important ones got to live in these houses, which were the only ones having bathtubs. Your friend must be the daughter of someone high up in the lab to live on Bathtub Row, Bitsy says. What's her last name? I don't know, I didn't ask. After dinner, Walter wants to see my course schedule. He hits the roof when he finds out that I am not taking a science course. How could they let you register without insisting on a science course? I wanted to take typing instead, I explain. I can always take chemistry next year. Typing, Walter says angrily. Ridiculous. And next year you should be taking Physics 1. You're going to fall behind. I feel like telling him that I have no intention of taking Physics 1. Not next year, and not ever. You have to think of your future, Walter tells me. You want to get into a good college, don't you? I don't know, I say. Of course you know. No, I don't. I don't even know if I want to go to college. Walter pours himself a glass of brandy, sloshes it around in his glass, then takes a hearty drink. What do you want to do with your life, Davy? He asks. How do I know? I'm only 15. It's never too soon to start planning, he calls. But I am already storming out of the room with Minka at my heels. I go straight to my mother's room to tell her that Walter is a pain and I don't feel like discussing my life with him, and she better do something about it, something to shut him up. But Mom is asleep, her mouth half open. Her breath sounds raspy. There are photos scattered across the bed. I feel so angry I want to shake her. I go to my own room and flop down on my bed with a copy of Great Expectations. I am on chapter 2 when Jason comes to my room. But I don't remember anything about chapter 1, and I can't keep any of the characters straight. What's wrong with Mom? Jason asks. You know, I tell him. She has headaches. He is wearing his football pajamas and looks very small and sweet. Don't worry. She'll be okay. Maybe not, he says. Maybe she's going to die. She's not going to die, I say. How do you know? I just do. If she does die, will we stay here with Uncle Walter and Aunt Bitsy? She's not going to die. But if she does... Yes, I say, closing my book. I suppose we'd stay here. That's all I wanted to know. Jason, I say. He has a loose tooth and he wiggles it with his fingers. He is so innocent, I think. Yeah? Aren't you going to kiss me goodnight? Me? Kiss you? Yes, come on. I hold my arms out to him. Pretend I'm not your sister. Pretend I'm some beautiful princess. He comes closer to my bed, and I reach out and hug him. It's going to be all right, I whisper into his hair. It is. It is. It is. Chapter 16. On Saturday, I ride to the canyon. There is a chill in the air, and I wear my fisherman's sweater. When I look up into the mountains, I see that the leaves of the aspen trees have turned color, making the whole mountainside a beautiful shade of gold against the deep blue of the sky. Tomorrow, Walter and Bitsy are taking us for a drive into the mountains so that we can see the aspen up close. I pedal hard and fast, anxious to reach the canyon. Wolf is there waiting for me.
Where have you been, Tiger?
School, I tell him. They made me go to school. School, he repeats, nodding. He doesn't ask who made me go. He doesn't ask why I haven't gone until now. We climb down into the canyon. I am able to climb much faster now. I have learned by watching and imitating Wolf. My hiking boots are comfortable on my feet, as if they belong there. At the bottom, we rest on a rock. Remember the time you told me I have sad eyes? I say.
I remember.
It's because my father's dead. Wolf looks at me, shakes his head slowly and says,
We have a lot in common, Tiger, because mine is dying.
Later, when it is time to leave the canyon, I say, I didn't make you laugh today. And Wolf says,
I didn't feel like laughing.
I ride home feeling very sad. I wish I could talk to my mother. But when I get back, she is sound asleep again, the shades in her room pulled down, making it as dark as night. Sometimes I feel she has vanished from my life, and I miss her. A few days later, Walter presents me with a small card.
Keep this in your wallet, Davy. Now that you're a member of this family, there's a space reserved for you in a bomb shelter.
A bomb shelter? I say, and I begin to laugh, half out of nervousness, half out of disbelief. But Walter looks very serious and says,
Yes. The numbers are printed on the card. Try to memorize them.
Are we going to have a war? I ask. Are we going to be bombed?
No, Walter says. At least I hope not. But it's always better to be prepared. The problem with this country is we never act until it's too late. The Russians, on the other hand, have an outstanding civil defense program. If they're attacked, chances are they'll survive. I wish I could say the same for us. It's just like the energy crisis. This country is waiting until the lights go out. Then we'll see how fast we accept nuclear energy. But by then it will be too late. Too late. Anyway, keep your card. Chances are you'll never need it.
Walter is full of gloom tonight, and he is on his third glass of brandy. Chapter 17. There are more than 250 clubs in this town, and Bitsy belongs to 9 of them, not counting morning walk, twice-a-week jazzercise, and batiking class. Her calendar is so full it looks like a doctor's appointment book. Still, she always has time for the family, especially Jason, who is growing closer and closer to her and Walter. One night I hear Bitsy telling Walter that Jason reminds her of Adam, when he was a boy. I think Bitsy misses my father more than she lets us know. There are a lot of clubs and associations at the high school, too. Danielle,
a girl in my American Cultures class, is trying to get me to join the Society for the Preservation of Creative Anachronisms. She dresses in a toga and medieval-type sandals that lace up her legs. She wears a fuzzy hobbit-like creature pinned to her shoulder. During class, she knits. I've never seen her take a note, yet I know she is a straight-A student. We have jousting matches, she tells me on Wednesday after class. She stands so close I can smell the garlic on her breath. I have no idea what creative anachronisms are, or why anyone would want to preserve them, but I say, look, I'm not really into jousting. She shakes her head, clearly disappointed, and drops an arm around my shoulder. You could give it a try. I inch away, wondering if she is gay. I'm overextended now, I tell her. This is an expression I've picked up from Bitsy, who uses it on the phone whenever she is asked to volunteer for this or that community activity. How so? Danielle asks, fingering the fuzzy creature on her shoulder as if it is alive. She is not one to give up easily. I've got a lot of family responsibilities, I tell her. I don't know why I am bothering to make excuses, since I don't owe her an explanation. Go on, she says. And I'm a candy striper at the hospital. This is not exactly true, but Jane has been after me to join with her, and now, on the spot, I decide that I will. Anything to get rid of Danielle. Danielle accepts this piece of information with a shrug. I thought you were the unusual type, she says, pulling a green cape around her shoulders. But I see that I was wrong. She swoops past me and out the door. I have learned plenty about the dynamics of this school in just 2 weeks. For one thing, everyone is classified by groups. There are coneheads, loadies, jocks, and stomps. Coneheads are into computers and wear calculators strapped to their belts. They are carbon copies of their fathers, grinding away for the best grades so that they can go to the best colleges. Loadies are into booze and drugs, and there is plenty available. You can buy whatever you want out of the trunk of a car in the parking lot. Jocks are jocks. Every group makes fun of every other group. Coneheads laugh at jocks. Jocks laugh at loadies. Loadies laugh at stomps. Stomps dress in 10-gallon hats and cowboy boots. They chew tobacco and spit and ride around in pickup trucks, looking for fights. I know that I will never fit in here. Of course, there are other kids like me. Other kids who don't fit in either. There is a girl, Anne, who screams in the hallways. I can't figure her out. Maybe she realizes the futility of trying to fit in, just as I do. There are guys who aren't really coneheads, but who aren't anything else either. And it's tough on them, because the kids here are very into putting down anybody and anything that is not exactly like they are. I sometimes think it would be terrific if all of us who don't fit in formed a group called the Leftovers. Then we could get together and laugh our heads off at the stomps, loadies, jocks, and coneheads. There are only one or two blacks in the school, and one night I ask Walter how come.
To tell the truth, Davy, he says, there are very few black scientists in this country. We're trying to recruit more. We're trying to encourage bright black boys and girls to get into science. There are scholarships available.
My friend Linnea wants to be a scientist, I remind him.
Yes, I know.
But it's not only blacks who are missing. In New Mexico, there are three cultures, Hispanic, Anglo, and Native American. When I was in third grade, we studied Native Americans, except we called them Indians. And what we learned about them then embarrasses me now. My family is Anglo, white, Caucasian. And we are in the minority in this state, but not in Los Alamos. Los Alamos is an Anglo town, absolutely. And in our high school, there are no Native Americans, and there are only a handful of Hispanic kids who happen to live here because their fathers work at the lab, doing maintenance. I head for my geometry class, but the teacher doesn't show. This isn't unusual. He has missed 5 classes since I came to school. And we've never had a substitute, which means he isn't absent for the day, but just for our class.
When he doesn't show, he arranges for us to see a film, usually having nothing to do with math. Most kids settle back and go to sleep. Someone almost always snores. A couple of kids use the darkened room to make out. But I don't mind the films. I find them more interesting than geometry. Today's film is about hemophilia. The narrator has a deep voice and says, "Hemophilia is a hereditary plasma coagulation disorder, principally affecting males but transmitted by females, and characterized by excessive, sometimes spontaneous bleeding." I already know this because in eighth grade, I read Nicholas and Alexandra. Still, I am not prepared to deal with a film on bleeding. My heart starts to pound, and I can't catch my breath. Halfway through the film, I have to leave the room, afraid that I am going to pass out. Reuben, who is somewhere between a conehead and a regular person, comes out into the hall after me. He is in three of my classes, and I have caught him watching me since the first day I came to the school. This is the first time he has spoken to me. "Can't stand the sight of blood, huh?" he jokes. I know that he means well, but as soon as he says it, I feel a wave of nausea, and I'm sure I am going to throw up. I press my head against the cool concrete wall of the corridor and count slowly to 20. The nausea passes. "You want some water?" Reuben asks. "No." "What can I do?" "Nothing," I say. "Go back to class." "What about you?" "I'm going home." And I walk right out of school. No permission, no excuses. I just take off and walk home. When I get there, the house is quiet. Bitsy is at the museum giving her tour. "And this is the bomb that we dropped on Nagasaki. And this is the bomb that we dropped on Hiroshima." I go upstairs passing my mother's room. I look in and see her sprawled across the bed. She is holding a couple of photos. "Mom," I say, "what are you doing?" She looks at me as if she doesn't know who I am. "You have to stop taking that headache medicine," I tell her. "Do you hear me? You have to stop." She nods. "Yes," she says, "I have to stop." I get this feeling that my mother and I have changed places, and I don't like it. That she is the little girl and I am the mother. I don't want this kind of responsibility laid on me, and I am glad that Walter and Bitsy are around. Yet I remember that when I fell apart and wouldn't get out of bed, Mom was there to help me get back on my feet. And something inside of me tells me that I shouldn't be angry at her now, that I should be helping. But I don't know what to do. It is more than the headache medicine, though. More than the headaches themselves. And this time, when Bitsy takes Mom to the doctor, he recommends therapy. He sets up an appointment at the family counseling center for Mom. She is to see someone named Miriam Alnick tomorrow afternoon. "I have to get myself together," Mom explains that night at the dinner table. It is the first time in a week that she is joining us for dinner. Jason taps his fork against the table, as if he is keeping time to some marching tune in his head. "I have to get myself together," Mom says again. Walter reaches over and covers Jason's hand with his, silencing the fork. "I'm not myself," Mom says. "I'm not the person I used to be before Adam." Her voice trails off, and there is a heavy silence at the table. It is the first time she has said his name out loud in front of us. "Before Adam." She tries again, but her voice breaks. "Died?" I say. Everyone looks at me. I feel my cheeks flush. Then everyone looks away as if I have broken some deep, dark secret. Jason goes back to tapping his fork against the table. "Well," Bitsy finally says, trying to sound cheerful. "You know how quickly food cools off in the high altitude." And she serves each of us a healthy portion of chicken tetrazzini. Chapter 18. I tell Jane that I have decided to join Candy Stripers with her.
She says, "Terrific. It'll look really good on our college applications."
I think about explaining that that's not the reason I'm joining, that college is about the farthest thing from my mind right now, that I don't even know if I want to go to college. But I decide to say nothing. I don't feel like getting into another hassle over my future. We walk to the Los Alamos Medical Center together. We go to a room marked Director of Volunteers, where we listen to a lecture on the duties of all after-school helpers. There are about 15 of us, and 3 are boys. I try to picture them dressed in candy-striped jumpers, and I begin to giggle. Once I get started, I can't stop. Jane looks over at me and raises her eyebrows. I look away and try to control myself. "Basically," the director says, "your duties are to assist the nurses and the aides. You'll be delivering mail and flowers, making sure that the patients have fresh water, and helping to serve the evening meal. You may not, under any circumstances, administer medication to the patients, nor can you bring them anything to eat or drink except what has been ordered for them. Occasionally, one of our volunteers runs into a troublesome patient. If that happens, report directly to me." Jane leans over and whispers,
"When my sister was a candy striper, she had a patient who flashed her."
I mouth the word "gross" at Jane, then go back to listening to the director.
"We certainly appreciate your time and assistance," she says. "And now, if you'll come with me, we'll see about your uniforms and you can get to work."
I don't have to worry about the boys walking around in jumpers after all. They are issued white shirts and candy-striped ties. My first job is pushing the water cart down the hall, stopping at each room and filling the patients' pitchers with fresh water and ice. I go into a semi-private room. There are flowers all over the place. Both patients are middle-aged women, and neither one looks especially sick. They are sitting up in their beds reading, one, a Harold Robbins novel, the other, Atlantic Monthly. They barely glance my way as I fill their water pitchers. The next room is also a semi-private, but there is just one patient, an older man. He is bald, very thin, and his skin is a grayish color.
"Hello," he says. "I've been waiting for you."
He speaks in a lyrical New Mexican accent. I've been listening to the Spanish radio station in my room at night. I love the sound of the language, even though I don't understand a word. And the same musical sound carries through to the Hispanic's English. "You've been waiting for me?" I say.
"For any pretty girl."
"Uh-oh," I think, remembering Jane's story about her sister and the flasher. If he tries anything funny, I will just tell him to put it away, and I will go directly to the volunteer's office. I fill his water pitcher, and when my back is turned, he says,
"Look at this."
I spin around, almost dropping the pitcher, and see him winding up a toy. It is a dancing bear. He places it on his bedside table, and the bear dances around in a circle.
"My son brought it to me, from California. He goes to school there."
I laugh nervously, partly at the dancing bear, and partly at myself, for having been so suspicious.
"Does your father work at the lab?"
he asks. "No, but my uncle does," I tell him.
"I'm on the maintenance crew 15 years.
He holds out his hand to shake mine and introduces himself.
"Willie Ortiz."
His hand is bony and fragile, and when I shake it, I can't help noticing the difference between mine and his. "I'm Davy Wexler," I tell him. He winds up the dancing bear again, and this time my laugh is genuine. "That's so cute."
"You like it? It's yours."
And he holds it out to me before it has wound down, so that the bear's legs are still moving. "Oh no," I say. "I can't."
"Why not?"
"Because," I begin. "Because it's yours."
"Híjole, you're a tough one. I tell you what, I'm not going to be here for long. And when I'm gone, I want you to have it. Okay?"
"Sure, okay."
"It's cancer, you know." but I'm ready to die.
He says it so easily, I am sure I have misunderstood.
For a long time, he says. Too long. In and out of the hospital. But this is the end.
I turn away and look out the window. The sun is setting. I've never seen anything like a New Mexican sunset. The whole sky turns pink, then red, then purple. Why did he have to tell me he is dying?
Don't be sad, he says.
I face him again, hoping he won't see how close to tears I am. Well, I say, I'll see you next week.
Sure, next week.
After work, I meet Jane outside. It is growing cold and dark. I button my jacket and turn up the collar. I'm going to have to buy a hat and gloves.
How did it go? Jane asks.
Okay.
Any trouble?
No. You?
Nothing.
We begin to walk home.
If you had your choice, I say, would you rather die slowly of cancer or fast? Like being shot.
I'm not sure, Jane says.
With the cancer, you'd have time to get ready. And you'd feel so sick, you'd probably want it to be over.
If you got shot, well, it'd be so sudden.
I don't wait for her to finish. I interrupt with, you wouldn't have time to say goodbye.
Chapter 19. Bitsy is reading a book called How to Feed Your Kids Right. And now every morning, Jason and I get a teaspoon of raw bran in our cereal. This will prevent hemorrhoids in later life, Bitsy assures us.
What's a hemorrhoid? Jason asks.
Never mind, Bitsy says. Just eat your cereal with bran and you'll never have to know.
But if I don't know what it is, how do I know I don't want it?
Believe me, Bitsy says, you don't. Bitsy is taking us very seriously, as if we are her kids, as if we are her responsibility. But I figure we'll be going home soon, maybe before Christmas, because Mom has seen Miriam Alnick at the Family Counseling Center 4 times in the past 2 weeks. She has joined Bitsy's jazzercise class and is looking healthier. She is still tense and apt to run off to her room when you least expect it, but she's getting better. Although sometimes when I am trying to talk to her, like about Bitsy giving me an allowance, she spaces out and I know she's not hearing a word I say. What do you and Miriam talk about? I ask one evening. I'm sitting on the kitchen counter, nibbling a piece of celery, and Mom is fixing her specialty, spinach pie. She has volunteered to make dinner tonight, to give Bitsy a break, but I don't think Bitsy is overjoyed. She considers the kitchen her turf. This is the first time that Mom has cooked a meal since we got to Los Alamos.
We talk about everything, Mom says. It's easy to talk to her.
Do you talk about Dad? I ask. About that night? Mom hesitates, then says,
yes.
She says it very quietly, and she doesn't look up. How come she can talk about him to Miriam, but not to me? When dinner is ready, I help Mom serve it. Walter just picks at the spinach pie, and I feel angry at him for making Mom think there is something wrong with it. He makes things even worse by saying,
it's good, Gwen. It's just that I had a big lunch.
It's outstanding, Bitsy says. I haven't had spinach pie for years. Walter doesn't like... She stops abruptly and covers her mouth with her hand, realizing her mistake.
I guess you could say I'm strictly a meat and potatoes man, Walter explains.
It's all right, Mom says. I should have asked before I made it. I am hoping that Mom doesn't break down and cry over this. She sounds as if she is on the brink. I wish we could just laugh it off, but there is too much tension at the table for laughing. I can't help remembering that we had spinach pie on the night that my father died. We'd been walking on the beach, all 4 of us, singing "This Old Man" at the top of our lungs. Mom and Dad had their arms around each other and were in one of their touchy-feely moods. I was thinking about later, about going out with Hugh, when Jason came up from behind and dumped a pail of water over my head. With his Dracula cape flying behind him, he ran away yelling, "Can't catch me! Can't catch me!" And then we went home for supper. Spinach pie, a green salad, and sourdough bread. I wonder if Jason remembers that too. I look over at him. He is shoveling in his food. "So, what's new in school, Jace?" I ask. "My teacher's so tall she can open the windows without a pole." "Wow. That tall, huh?" "And smart, too," Jason says. "She knows everything." "She sounds great," I tell him. "I told you we had excellent schools here," Bitsy says. The next night, I am lying on the living room floor, playing Monopoly with Jason. Jason lands on Virginia Avenue. And even though I already own St. Charles Place and State Street, he buys it. He never misses a chance to buy Virginia Avenue, because that's where we live in Atlantic City. Playing Monopoly reminds me of home. Walter and Bitsy are taking Mom to a party tonight. Mom comes downstairs wearing her long skirt and a black sweater. She looks nice and I tell her so. "Thanks, honey," she says. "And you smell good too," Jason says as she kisses him goodnight. "It's Chanel number 5. I bought it today." I roll the dice, move my man 8 spaces and land on go to jail. "Too bad," Jason says, holding up his get out of jail free card. Walter helps Bitsy and then Mom into their coats. Mom says, "The police and fire department numbers are on the bulletin board in the kitchen, and so is the number at the Grants where we're going. If there's any trouble, just call us there." "Hey, Mom," I say. "I used to babysit all the time in Atlantic City. Remember? I know what to do." Mom looks doubtful and turns to Bitsy. "I don't know. Maybe I should stay home tonight. I'm not really feeling up to a party."
"Nonsense," Walter says. "It will do you good."
"Don't let anyone in," Mom says to me. "I don't care who they say it is. I don't care if they say it's the police. Don't open the door for anyone." "It's all right, Gwen," Bitsy says. "There's no place safer than the hill, believe me." I realize suddenly what this is all about. Tonight is the first time Mom is leaving us alone at night. The first time since my father was killed. I hear the front door close.
"Okay," Jason says. "I'm building a hotel on Boardwalk, and another one on Park Place, and 2 houses on..." "Have you been stealing from the bank, you little creep?"
Jason has trouble keeping a straight face.
"Who? Me?"
I know that he has. That while I was talking with Mom, he was helping himself to $500 bills. I let out a whoop, and Jason takes off, racing through the house. I chase him and we both laugh our heads off. When I finally catch him, I pin him down and begin to tickle him.
"No, please, stop, stop,"
Jason screams. I stop, but I don't let him up. We are both out of breath and panting. After a while, I say, "Jason, do you miss Daddy?" Jason turns his head to the side. "Do you?" He mashes his lips together and doesn't answer. "I know you do, Jason. So why don't you ever say it? And why don't you ever cry?"
"Crying is for babies," he mumbles.
"No," I tell him. "It's for everyone. When you feel sad, it's okay to cry."
"Let me up," he says.
"Not until you say it. Not until you say you miss Daddy."
"No."
He struggles to get away from me.
"Okay," I tell him. "Then I'll say it for you. I miss Daddy. I miss him a lot."
I move aside then and Jason gets up and runs away from me.
"Jason," I call. "Don't you want to finish our game?"
But he's already upstairs.
"Finish it yourself,"
he calls back, and he is crying. I don't know why I did that. I don't know why I spoiled our game, our evening together. It's just that I have this need to talk about my father, with someone who knew him, and loved him the way I did. Chapter 20. Jane phones and invites me to sleep over on Saturday night.
Come early, she says, so we can spend the afternoon together.
Bitsy is impressed when she hears that I am going to spend the night at the Albertsons' house. You know that Bud Albertson is a division leader and a very important part of the policy-making group at the lab. There are those who say that Bud has more clout than the director. I didn't know, I say. I do not add that I don't care. And Brenda is in my Thursday night group. Bitsy's Thursday night group reads and discusses current books. This week it is a biography of Georgia O'Keeffe. I pack a small bag and walk over to Jane's house. It is my first visit to Bathtub Row. When I get there, her brother-in-law, Howard, is in the driveway, waxing a pair of skis. I have never seen Howard, but Jane has described her whole family to me. Howard is tall and thin and trying to grow a beard. Jane's sister is the first person he ever had sex with, and that was after they were married. I know a lot about Jane's family. I know that her parents make love once a week, on Saturday nights.
Hello, Howard says to me. You must be Davy.
Yes. Jane's inside. The house looks like a log cabin. It is set back from the road and surrounded by pinyon pine and blue spruce trees. I knock on the front door and Jane lets me in.
Hi, she says. Come and meet my mom.
Inside, the house looks like a regular house, except for the logs showing through on one of the living room walls, giving it a rustic look. I follow Jane to the kitchen where she introduces me to her mother, Brenda, who is chubby and dimpled, with a face like Jane's. She is baking cookies. Bitsy does a lot of baking too. Jason has become her apprentice. Together they bake chocolate chips, lemon iced, sugar-coated, oatmeal, applesauce, pinwheel, you name it, they bake it. I have this fantasy that Jason will get so good at baking cookies that when we go back to Atlantic City, we'll open a cookie shop on the boardwalk. A really classy place. And we'll call it Jason Wexler, Cookie Specialist, or something like that. I'll do the publicity, and Mom will take care of the business side of things. We'll make a fortune. All the big hotels will have branches of our shop. And we'll ship all over the world, just like James's saltwater taffy shops. We'll live in a penthouse apartment in one of the new hotels, with a view of the ocean from every room.
Hello, dear, Jane's mother says. I'm so glad to meet you.
There's a fat, beautiful baby crawling around on the kitchen floor. Jane scoops him up and plants a juicy kiss on his face. And this is my nephew, Robbie. Isn't he adorable? Jane passes him to me and he grabs a fistful of my hair and tries to chew on it. We all laugh as he babbles to us in baby talk. Robbie belongs to Howard, who is in the driveway, and to Linda, Jane's sister. She is the one who was once a finalist in the Miss New Mexico contest. Jane's other sister, Taffy, is in business school in Albuquerque. She comes home every other weekend.
Where's your father? I ask Jane as we walk through the house.
In his study, Jane whispers, pointing to a closed door. He's thinking. He always thinks on Saturdays. But you'll meet him later. He usually comes out to dinner. Come on upstairs.
My room is a mess. I'm in the middle of cleaning out my closet. I follow Jane up the stairs, admiring the polished wooden banister, which feels cool and sleek under my hand. My mother is president of the Women's Hiking Association, Jane says over her shoulder. She knows the name of every wildflower in the Southwest.
That's nice, I say.
Jane wasn't kidding about her room. It's a mess, with clothes scattered all over the place.
I told you, she says, laughing.
Where's the bathtub? I ask.
You want to take a bath? Now?
No, I say, and I start to laugh too.
I want to see it for historical reasons.
Oh, that, she says. Come on. She takes my hand and leads me down a hallway and into the bathroom. Voila, she says. The tub is old-fashioned. It stands off the floor on feet, and has separate faucets for hot and cold water. I look around for a sign that says, J. Robert Oppenheimer bathed here, but I don't see one. New Jersey is full of signs proclaiming, George Washington slept here. I try to picture Oppenheimer sitting in the tub. Maybe he got his ideas while he was soaking, or maybe he sailed plastic boats like Jason does. Who knows? We go back to Jane's room and I flop down on her bed. She turns on the radio. An old Eagles song is playing. She begins to fold her clothes and put them away. I hum along with the radio and look around Jane's room. She has three posters taped to her wall. One of Jimmy McNichol, one of Eric Heiden on skates, and one of Bjorn Borg. They are all covered with lipstick kisses. It's how I blot my lipstick, Jane explains when she sees me studying them. I understand. I used to practice kissing on my pillow, but I don't tell this to Jane. Instead, I say, you hardly ever wear lipstick. I used to, she says. I was really into makeup in 9th grade. I'm surprised. Jane doesn't seem the type to experiment with makeup. But then I remember that Linnea and I used to go to Woolworth's and try out all the samples on the counter when we were in 8th grade. When Jane has finished putting away her clothes, and the room looks reasonably neat, she takes out a Revlon nail care kit and begins to give herself a manicure. Where do you want to go to college? She asks as she files her nails. I don't know, I say. It's not as if we're seniors and have to decide right away. But it's something you have to plan for early. I don't even know if I want to go, I tell her. Really? Yes. And I think it's stupid to worry about it so far in advance. You never know what's going to happen between now and then. I never thought of it that way, Jane says. My father wants me to go to MIT because that's where he went. And my mother is talking up Wellesley because that's where she went. My parents expect a lot of me. She is painting her nails a pale peach color. Linda and Taffy were big disappointments, especially to my father. Neither one of them ever did much in school. So it's all up to me. Nobody's going to tell me what to do with my life, I say. You're braver than I am. It doesn't have anything to do with being brave. I think it does. When her nails are polished to perfection, she holds them up, admiring her work. Want me to do yours? She asks, as she blows on her own. I look at my fingernails. They're a mess. I haven't paid any attention to them since last August. I used to keep them clipped short, but now they're all different lengths and ragged at the tips. You could use a good manicure, Jane says. No offense, but I've noticed. I nod and agree to let her do my nails. She shapes them with an emery board. Her touch is light. The phone rings in the hall before Jane has finished filing the nails on my left hand. She rushes out to answer it. I pick up a copy of 17 and browse through it. The models are all perfect. I wish some of them had zits or oily hair. I go to the mirror and examine my face. It is not one of my better days. I look tired and my hair is limp. When Jane comes back, her face is flushed and she says, "That was Ted." Ted hangs out with Reuben, the guy who was always looking at me. I have suspected for weeks that Jane has a thing for Ted. This confirms it. He wants to come over tonight, she says excitedly, with Reuben. She pauses and looks at me. I said it would be okay. Jane sits down and reaches for my hand. I hold it out and she continues to file my nails. If it's not okay with you, I can call him back and tell him to make it another time. Sometimes Jane is so polite it gets to me. We'll just take a walk or something, she says. No big deal. I thought it would be okay with you. Otherwise, I wouldn't have said yes. I can't bring myself to say that it is okay,
and I don't know why. Jane has filed my pinky nail down to nothing.
Look, she says, her eyes wide. Just forget it. I'll go call him and make up some excuse.
No, I finally manage. It's okay. I don't mind. She looks relieved.
It's not as if you hate him, she says.
Right. I don't hate him.
Jane holds up a bottle of nail polish. How about this one? She asks. I think it'll look really good on you, with your coloring. She begins to paint my fingernails, and the color, which looks almost brown in the bottle, turns out to be a putrid shade of purple.
Do you have a lot of experience? She asks.
In what? I say, thinking she is talking about my fingernails.
You know, with boys.
Oh, boys.
Do you?
Not much, I tell her.
How much?
Some.
I don't have any, she says. I've kissed 2 boys and that's it.
Don't worry about it, I say.
Don't worry about it? She repeats. What else is there to worry about?
Not counting school. Sometimes, Jane seems so innocent, I can't believe we are the same age.
You know how I found out about sex? She asks.
No, how?
I looked it up in the card catalog, in the library.
I laugh.
Really?
Really.
You'd think that with 2 older sisters, someone would have given me the facts. But when I asked them, they said, go ask mother. And when I asked my mother, she said, you're too young to be asking about that. You'd think that they'd give us sex education in school, wouldn't you? I mean, it's all in the best interest of science.
Now we both laugh. So how far have you gone? Jane asks.
I don't answer her. Instead, I examine my nails and say, thanks, they look nice. Then I blow on them, the way Jane did hers, to help them dry faster.
All the way? Jane says.
I realize that because I avoided the answer to her question, she thinks I have a lot of experience. I try to set the record straight. No, I say emphatically, not all the way.
Close? She asks.
No, not even close. I don't tell her about Hugh. I don't tell her about the hot, sweaty summer nights, about the salty taste of his lips, about his body pressed against mine. That is not for sharing. Not with Jane. Not with anyone. Before dinner, I take a bath in the famous tub. I soak for a long time. My hair fans out in the water, which comes up to my chin. Usually, I try not to think about Hugh and how it was with us, because then I get all worked up, and I don't want to deal with any of those feelings now. But I do remember. I remember everything, especially the last night.
So what's new, Davina? Hugh asked. He knew my real name but called me Davina as a joke.
Not much, I said. We were sitting on the railing overlooking the beach, eating soft ice cream cones. We'd already cruised the boards in a motorized wicker chair, and now it was dark. I clicked my feet together, and one of my flip-flops fell off and landed on the sand. Hugh jumped down to retrieve it. As he put it back on my foot, he caressed the inside of my leg. How about a walk on the beach, Davina?
Come on, Hugh. You know I can't.
I can't. I can't, he said, mimicking me.
You know it's a rule.
And rules are made to be broken, right?
Not this one, I said. But you can come back to our place. Your father will be there. So, there's always the backyard. It wasn't that I didn't want to take a walk on the beach with Hugh. I did. I loved the idea of the moonlight on the ocean, the sand beneath our feet, of being alone, really alone with him. But I'd promised my parents that I wouldn't.
So Hugh and I walked home and went directly to the small yard behind the store. I leaned back against the willow tree. The single light from the store cast a shadow on the scrubby grass. Hugh's arms were around me, his lips on my face, my neck. His breath was hot. I clutched his damp t-shirt as he slid his hand from my shoulder to the top of my halter, to my waist, and then back up again. The smell of my Charlie was in the air. From the store, we could hear a symphony playing on my father's radio. We were both breathing hard. Hugh's body was pressed against mine, and he whispered, "Davy. Oh, Davy." My knees were so weak I wanted to lie down. To lie down in Hugh's arms and let whatever might happen, happen. Whatever. But then we heard a firecracker. And another. And another. And another. Hugh pulled away from me saying, "What the hell?" Then both of us were running, running toward the store. Chapter 21.
"Davy, are you almost done?" Jane calls, knocking on the bathroom door. "Dinner's ready."
"Be right out," I call back, swallowing the sob that was working its way up into my throat. I splash my face, step out of the tub, and dry off. Downstairs, everyone is seated around the dinner table. They are waiting for us.
"Sorry," I say. "I didn't know it was so late."
"That's all right, dear," Jane's mother says. Jane's father is at the head of the table. He is a big man, with jowly cheeks, steel-rimmed glasses, and gray wiry hair that is cut short. I notice the scar across his forehead. Jane told me that a year ago, he was in a serious auto accident. I try not to stare at him as I take my seat. He says,
"Hello, Davy."
Then he and Howard engage in a lengthy conversation about the lab. I don't even try to follow what they are talking about. Robbie sits in a high chair next to Linda, and she feeds him bits and pieces from the table. I see that Linda is pregnant again, and wonder why Jane hasn't told me. The conversation at our end of the table centers around skiing. Linda and Jane both hope that it will snow early so that the ski area will be open before Christmas.
"Do you ski, Davy?" Jane's mother asks.
"No, but I'd like to learn."
"I don't either," she says. "But Dr. Albertson is an outstanding skier, and all three girls have followed in his footsteps." At first, I'm not sure who Dr. Albertson is. Then I realize it is Jane's father. I tend to think of the word doctor as meaning medical doctor or even dentist, but Los Alamos is full of PhDs who call each other doctor.
"And don't forget Howard," Linda says. "Howard's a fantastic skier. He practically grew up on skis. He's from Canada." I wonder if Linda will ski this winter even though she is pregnant. I decide not to ask. Maybe she isn't pregnant after all. Maybe she's just fat.
"Robbie's going to learn as soon as he's 3,
Linda says, giving him another bread crust. We have chocolate cake and vanilla ice cream for dessert. And when we are finished, Jane's father stands and says,
"Very nice, Brenda."
Then he disappears into his study, and the rest of us do the dishes. At 8:30, Ted and Reuben ring the bell. Jane lets them in. They wait in the entrance foyer, rubbing their hands together. Their breath is smoky. We get our jackets and then the four of us take off, with Jane's mother calling,
"Button up! It's very cold."
Outside, Ted reaches behind a tree and comes up with a bottle of vodka. "Didn't think it was wise to carry it into the house."
"Good thinking," Jane says. Ted opens the bottle, and as we walk along, it is passed back and forth. I am not into booze and take only one swig. It burns going down my throat, and then again as it hits my stomach. Reuben takes a couple of swallows and says,
"Can't stand the stuff,
but it does warm you up."
I keep my hands in my pockets. I have the feeling that if I don't, Reuben will want to hold hands.
It's not that I don't like him. I think he's okay.